All right, we are back, and we are here to talk more about the consent of the governed. In this case, I want to talk about the consent of the governed, not in a philosophical sense, but more in a kind of direct practical sense. And we can look at some of what's going on in the world to get at what I think is ultimately the emptiness of this idea. And so the first story that I want to talk about comes to us from Reason.com, and it's about this video right here. So I'll describe what's going on as we watch, but we have this is a dash cam from a police officer in Arkansas who, and we have a picture there of the officer, and he's pulling over this lady. You see the spotlight go on, you can see the lights go on, she's pulled over into the right lane, she's got her turn signal on. But she judges right now, we know this from later on, that the median or the shoulder there was too small and she couldn't pull over there. So she's about 2 minutes go by and the cop starts pulling up beside her and executes what's known as a pit maneuver. And a pit maneuver, as you'll see right here, is designed to stop a car chase. So this is a SUV being driven by a pregnant lady. And he does this. She spins out, and as you'll see in a second, something else terrifying happens. So he's now turned around on the highway. He's now driving the wrong direction down the highway. You can see the other traffic there has seen what's going on and has stopped. And her car actually flips over in the middle of the road. So, to be fair, she wanted to wait until she found an exit to pull over. She was in the right lane, slowed down, had her hazards on, and the cop walks up to the car after the end of this video, which is about to end here, and he says to her, "Well, why didn't you stop? You're supposed to stop when law enforcement pulls you over." And she said, "I was looking for a safe place to stop." Now, some rather enthusiastic thin blue line supporters on places like social media said, "Well, you know, she should have just stopped. She should have just complied." Interestingly enough, the guidelines for drivers in Arkansas disagree with these people, in that the guidelines for Arkansas drivers say if it seems like the shoulder is too small or not a safe place to pull over, then yes, you can drive down the road and look for a safe place to stop. And I didn't have audio on this video here, but in the version with audio, you can tell that the officer in question does not radio in that he's executing this maneuver, which is, again, designed to stop car chases, people who are fleeing, which she clearly was not. And now she's suing this officer for damages, I suppose damages to her car and probably some like well-being damages. But Reason.com, among others, has a good take on this story. So cop flipped pregnant woman's SUV while she was searching for a safe place to pull over. Nicole Harper, pregnant with her daughter, was driving her SUV home on an Arkansas freeway in July 2020. When Arkansas State Trooper Rodney Dunn decided to stop her for allegedly driving 84 in a 70-mile-per-hour zone. So, following what she understood to be safe procedure in this situation, Harper moved into the right lane, slowed down, turned on her hazards to indicate to the officer she understood what was going on, and was seeking a safe shoulder or exit to pull over. And as some people also pointed out on social media, I don't know how true this is, but apparently there are some instances of people pretending to be cops who have like fake lights on their car that will pull people over and then rob them or rape them or do terrible things to them. But even in theory, if a cop is knocking at my front door, if a cop is pulling me over, really it's a good idea to call into the station and say, "Hey, there's this guy who's looks like a police officer and wants me to stop or wants me to do this or wants me to do that. Can we just confirm that this person is real or radio in, talk to this person, tell him I'm not fleeing at the very least?" That would be a good safety precaution. But we have to ask ourselves, like Alan Watts pointed this out, and I don't know how sound his logic is, but it seems apropos for right now. He said, you know, it's interesting. We say that we pay taxes so that the police will protect us. So then if I get pulled over and given a ticket by the police And so I pay taxes so that the cop will pull me over. I'm paying the police to protect me from me. And this goes back to what Thoreau talked about in Civil Disobedience. He said, I see no need to inculcate a respect for law, but rather for what is right. And so when what is legal and what is right diverge, I will do what is right. And so we see the breakdown of our system here. Or we see the problem with a legal system here, in that a legal system cannot account for those instances in which the law diverges from what is right. The law has to prosecute people who do what's right if what's right is not what's legal. And those who have lived under repressive regimes will have a very vivid example of what it looks like when the law and what's right diverge too much. Because as we can see, no sane person could have imagined Harper's behavior, could have imagined from her behavior that she was involved in any active attempt to escape the raw justice of a speeding ticket. She was clearly not fleeing, in other words. Fewer than 2 or 3 minutes had passed since the cop first turned on his lights, but he just decided that he wasn't having it, and so he flipped the car over with this maneuver, using an insanely dangerous strategy that police in Arkansas are using more and more, 144 times last year, right? That's a little less than once every other day. And that's double the number of times they did it in 2019, the year before. He slammed into her SUV, causing her to hit the concrete median and flipping her SUV. The practice, called the Precision Immobilization Technique, or PIT, killed at least 3 people in 2020. And in this case, would have killed 1 or 2 people, depending on your views on whether a fetus constitutes a life. But that's not a topic we're going to get into right now. So yeah, that stops someone from speeding. It forces someone to pull over, or at least stops the car, stops this so-called pursuit. But it also runs a real risk of killing this person. And so this goes back to things like the killing of George Floyd. He passed a $20 bill, ended up in an interaction with the police, and now he's dead. And so some people would be want to say, for example, that, oh, his punishment for passing a fake $20 bill was death. Or that a person who didn't pull over fast enough, the punishment was death. Now, there's those, of course, who are more in favor of police power who say things like, well, if you just complied, you wouldn't have this problem. But of course, that assumes perfect behavior on the part of the police. And we all know that police are just people. Well, most of us know that anyway. Some people seem to think that they're like some kind of heroes or something. But in reality, they're people and their behavior is imperfect. And obviously, there are opportunities for this sort of abuse, which is, to me, is very, very obvious abuse. There's no way that you can make the case that this person felt like he was threatened, that his safety was at risk. No, the person didn't pull over fast enough, and so he just executed this pit maneuver and brought her to a stop, but he also flipped her car upside down. And I feel like we're not acknowledging the gravity of that situation, of flipping someone's car over. First of all, hard to do. Second of all, really intense thing to do. And she posed no threat to anyone. The only threat was that this officer was not obeyed fast enough. And that's certainly not a society that I want to live in. I'll take Thoreau and Socrates over that. So post-assault, they're calling it an assault. The dialogue goes, as reported by a local NBC station, the cop says, "Why didn't you stop?" And Harper said, "Because I didn't feel it was safe." She's surprisingly calm in this interaction for someone whose car was just flipped over. I feel like I would be probably screaming at this point. And Dunn responded, when she said, "I didn't feel it was safe," Dunn responded, "Well, this is where you ended up." Harper went on to say, quote, "I thought it would be safe to wait until the next exit." And Dunn said, "No, ma'am, you pull over when law enforcement stops you. Uh-uh. You don't get to choose where to pull over. I choose where you pull over. And if you don't agree, I'm going to flip your car over." Right? Dunn can be heard saying, "No, we don't anticipate vehicles rolling over, nor do we want that to happen. All you had to do was slow down and stop." And she responded, I did slow down. I turned on my hazards. I thought I was doing the right thing. And she was doing the right thing. Just to be clear, by the textbook of Arkansas state law and the procedures for drivers, she did do the right thing. He did the wrong thing. But he has so far faced no consequences, though she is trying to take him to court. But we will be following this story to see how it ends up. And of course, we have to talk a little bit about surveillance if we're going to talk about the consent of the governed, right? As George Carlin said, I love this country. I love that we're on camera from all angles at all times. And the amount of cameras and the number of different people watching those cameras has multiplied since he said that, like 30 years ago, 40 years ago. To the point that today people are installing cameras inside their own homes as a way to ostensibly make those homes safer. But as it turns out, that's also another way to make things less safe. As we see from Fox 4 News here, ex-Texas ADT employee, that's not good phrasing, an ex-ADT employee from Texas is sentenced. He's going to go to prison for 4 years after admitting to hacking cameras to watch customers have sex. A former ADT employee has been sentenced to more than 4 years in federal prison for hacking into women's security video feeds and watching them. Telesforo Aviles, 35, was sentenced to 52 months in prison on Wednesday after pleading guilty to computer fraud in January. Now, of course, you might look at this story and say, well, I mean, come on, man, be serious. This is one insane lunatic. Regular people don't have to worry about this sort of thing. This is just one guy who managed to hack into, well, he didn't hack into it. He used the fact that he had access to their security feeds when he was setting them up, and he would add his email address to the list of email addresses that could sign in and watch the inside the house feed. And then he would go later and log on and watch people in their houses. Which is not a behavior that I really understand, you know? You know, a guy robs a bank, and I say, well, you know, the law is the law, he has to go to prison, but I understand. Because I feel like I could do some good stuff with all that money. This I don't really understand. It just seems a little weird. But point being that, to quote Batman, any tool can also be a weapon. And in this case, a tool that was supposed to keep me safe got turned into a weapon. A weapon to be used by Telesforo Aviles, this kind of weird guy. But this speaks to a lot of the kind of tension and what some would call paranoia around these smart home devices or things like Amazon Alexa. There's all those creepy videos of Alexa giggling in the middle of the night, which, what? Why? Somebody, that I feel like that has to be another one of these Telesforo Aviles types who are like, I got an idea, let's program Alexa to giggle in the night. That'll be hilarious. But in reality, there's a much more real version of this, and it comes to us here from Ars Technica. Amazon devices will soon automatically share your internet with your neighbors. And there's some serious security concerns here as well. There could be more Texas ADT employees floating around using this service and gaining access to a lot of stuff. So what could possibly go wrong, Ars Technica writes? Amazon's experimental wireless mesh networking turns users into guinea pigs. If you use Alexa, Echo, or many other Amazon devices, you have only 10 days until you're opted into an experiment that leaves your personal privacy and security hanging in the balance. On June 8th, so a couple days ago, the merchant, web host, and entertainment behemoth, Amazon, will automatically enroll these devices in Amazon Sidewalk. The new wireless mesh service will share a small slice of your internet bandwidth with neighboring Sidewalk-capable devices that don't have connectivity. Sidewalk will also help your Amazon devices to a sliver of bandwidth from other Sidewalk users when you don't have a connection. And by default, a variety of Amazon devices will enroll in the system come June 8th. They're going to do it without really consulting you first. They're just going to kind of do it. So good luck. But since only a fraction of people, a tiny fraction of people, ever take the time to even look at their default settings, most people are just going to be doing this, and they're not going to realize that they're doing this. Most people are going to be signed up for Amazon Sidewalk. Most people are using it right now and don't realize that they're using it. So, moving on to the next of our kind of short topics here, there is a certain personality type that's associated with enjoying this sort of thing. Not peeping on people using technical means, but on the idea of increasingly integrating ourselves into this kind of digital network. SciPost.org writes, "The dark personality trait known as Machiavellianism predicts support for mind upload technology." So we're all familiar with mind upload technology. It's I think Elon Musk has talked a lot about this because, you know, he always knows the right thing to say. But the idea is that with mind upload technology, I can upload my brain, my consciousness, my selfhood to some sort of computer network, to the internet. And in so doing, I would thereby achieve immortality as long as the network continues to exist. Sounds interesting, I'm sure, at least to some people. But as it turns out, those some people, are a very certain kind of people. And they're associated with this Machiavellianism trait. So Machiavellianism, for those who are familiar with their Renaissance political thinkers, comes from Niccolo Machiavelli, author of The Prince, and one of history's great misunderstood thinkers, to my way of thinking, because Machiavelli was not all about, oh, here's how to manipulate and be a terrible person. In fact, Machiavelli says in, I believe it's in The Prince, or perhaps in one of his other works, he says, look, a prince, a ruler, someone with power, should be good. But sometimes being in power requires that he not be so good. And when those circumstances arise, it's a good idea to know how to do bad stuff really well. Because I suppose, at least as Machiavelli's thinking goes, the only thing worse than someone who's adept at doing bad things is someone who tries to do bad things but is really bad at it. You can question that and fight with that notion, but at least to Machiavelli's way of thinking, that seems to be superior. And so at least a prince who is willing to do evil things does them well and doesn't cause chaos in the process, even if he is betraying his friends who were secretly enemies, so on and so forth. But the trait known as Machiavellianism is not related to that. The trait known as Machiavellianism is so named because of the reputation that Machiavelli acquired over the last 500 years since he wrote his book. And the reputation that he acquired was for teaching people how to do evil. Not entirely undeserved, but it morphed into being Machiavellian means manipulating all people all the time. So, if you're really good at making yourself cry in order to manipulate people into doing what you want, you might have some of this Machiavellian trait in you. If you're really good at flattering people to get them to do your work for you at your place of employment, you might have a little bit of this Machiavellian trait in you. So SciPost writes, manipulative individuals who endorse the belief that, quote, the ends justify the means, are more likely to endorse technology that allows a person to upload their human consciousness into a machine, according to new research published in Personality and Individual Differences, the scholarly journal. The study indicates that there's a strong link between the personality trait known as Machiavellianism and acceptance of mind uploading. So what might be the case here? Is it perhaps the case that the sort of people who look for opportunities to take advantage of other people or systems love the idea that everybody's got cameras in their house? Love the idea that all of my bank transactions are available on the internet for anyone smart enough to hack into them? They love the idea of getting into government, a government that can track all of your financial transactions? Is it perhaps the case that the politicians that govern us are themselves like this? After all, Machiavelli was writing about politics. Dan Stewart pointed out, politics remains the same. Politicians remain the same. Their primary art is deception. So maybe it's not so crazy. The new findings, the article says, shed light on how psychological dispositions are related to approval of futuristic technology. Quote, throughout my life, I've been hanging out with individuals who self-identify as transhumanists. This is different than transgender. These people are interesting since their values and orientation toward daily life are so different from others, explains study author Michael Lacasuo, an adjunct professor of cognitive science at the University of Helsinki and principal investigator of the Moralities and Intelligent Machines research group. Many transhumanists, he says, are supporters of and advocates for mind upload technology, and this technology is being developed. Transhumanists have participated in ethical and philosophical discussions on the risks and potential downsides of this technology. However, moral psychologists and experimental philosophers still have not picked up this baton or investigated what are the individual differences or cognitive processes, if any, that bring in support or resistance toward this technology. So this is purely correlative. We don't have there's no mechanism for establishing causation here. But they tend to be similar groups of people. And those of us who enjoy the believing when whatever is the more fun thing to believe would prefer to believe that there is some causal relation here, that there is some reason why if you have Machiavellian traits, you're more likely to be all into uploading your brain to the internet somehow. But anyway, so as long as we're talking about structures and justice and things like that, I want to just mention this very quickly. This is from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. 15 universities have formed a company that looks a lot like a patent troll, right? Now, that's not a troll that you have patented. What it means is that they've formed a company that buys up, as they say, very questionable patents, low-level, low-quality patents of suspect validity, and then they go around to people who are using products similar to the low-quality patents that they have on file and suing these companies to get them to settle out of court and hand over money to the patent holder. Now, the idea is that the patents are low-quality in that maybe they're very vague, or maybe they're not for exactly the same thing as the company they're suing is actually using or doing. But the companies facing legal action are more likely to just pay up than they are to try to fight it out in court. Especially if they are like startups, especially if they're the kind of companies that don't really have the money to fight things out in court. Like, you're not going to pull this trick on Google because Google will fight you. You pull this trick on, you know, the company in a garage somewhere that has $800 in capital. You say, look, we're going to sue you for everything you're worth and you'll be broken out of business. Or you can just pay up and we'll settle out of court. It essentially amounts to a legal extortion racket. But now, apparently, UCLA is part of this group. So this company is real, what I'm describing here. And it's a patent commercialization company. It's been secretly under discussion since 2018. In September 2020, it quietly went public when the University of California Regents authorized making UC Berkeley and UCLA two of its founding members. So this means that the university holds all these patents, and they're going to go out and sue anybody who is violating their intellectual property. But as it turns out, a lot of the patents are low quality, and they may not be precisely for the things that the companies are suing over. So in January, the DOJ said it wouldn't challenge the program on antitrust grounds. And frankly, there's not a lot of antitrust argument here. The real argument is that they're misusing the law, not that they are a trust. And so what this speaks to is exactly what we've been talking about the whole time. We've been talking about the idea that you can have any legal system you want in place. You can put anything in. But it's still going to allow for injustice. If I really want to, I will find a way to game the legal system to do bad things to get stuff for myself. And so far more important than having a government that's going to make people moral, or having a government that operates on empathy or something like that, is to focus on building a, I call it a love of philosophy, but most people probably wouldn't call it that, building a moral population, building a group of people who care about doing the right thing regardless of what the law says. Because the right thing to do is not this, is not to extort companies in court just to make money, while really adding nothing to any economy or anyone's life. What's right doesn't allow for this kind of stuff. What's right governs my every breath, every movement, every thought has to be filtered through my idea of right and wrong. And so far more important it is to go out there and talk about right and wrong, to talk about philosophy, to talk about why it is that we do the things we do, and why we think certain things are right and certain things are wrong. Far more important it is to do that than it is to try to legislate everything. Because ultimately, in legislating everything, you create the ability for things like this to happen. In putting cameras everywhere, you don't make people more just. You give more opportunities for unjust people to take advantage of those systems. And so in answer to your question, Dylan Rockets, to Biden or Trump, I would say, frankly, neither. Trump was a lot more entertaining than Biden is. He was more fun, if you could say that. But I've reached a point where I'm no longer thinking that government can really solve my problems. That government can really solve most any problems, frankly. Most of the time, they just make things worse. And so Biden trying to pump trillions of dollars into the economy is a terrible idea that will, as we're about to talk about, result mostly in inflation and not in economic well-being. But Trump, on the other hand, with his economic protectionism, just he's trying to mess with something that I don't think he fully understands. And on top of that, tariffs don't really work. They don't produce the kind of economic growth you think they do. In fact, they end up making everything more expensive. Because there are some things it's just cheaper to make overseas. There are some things it's just better to do in other countries. And so the government getting in the way of that and putting their thumb on the scale, right? The scales of justice are held by a blind lady in a robe. If the government's got their thumb on one end of that scale, it's no longer justice. It's no longer balance. Now it's the, as Thrasymachus said in Plato's Republic, justice becomes the interest of the stronger. Good afternoon, democratic fascist. I'm not sure what a democratic fascist is. Is that like a democratic socialist, but with nationalism? So like Bernie Sanders, but really into the 4th of July. Something like that. I don't know. I hope you explain your name there a little bit more, because you've piqued my curiosity. But anyway, while we're waiting for the democratic fascist to tell us what on earth that combination of words means, I think we should talk about money. Nothing's more interesting than money, at least not in our capitalistic society here. And so, the Foundation for Economic Education points out that the IRS has gotten wrapped up in a little bit of a scandal. Oh, Democratic Fascist is saying more stuff. I want to get to this before we do the IRS. Democratic Fascist says it postulates that fascism can be an economic theory without any form of autocracy. Well, to be frank, if I remember my fascist history correctly, fascist economics, or at least fascism, is often characterized by kind of a lack of, I don't want to say a lack of respect, but a lack of interest in economic theory, right? Is there really like a well thought out and deep and sophisticated fascist economic theory? Because if I remember correctly, the fascist nations that have existed in the past would kind of operated on the principle that economics has to be subservient to politics, and that the autocracy is part and parcel of the fascist system. Maybe not necessarily like a dictator, but the idea is that government and private business, private corporations work hand in hand for their mutual benefit. So that's as best I understand it. So are you talking about like economic populism? And democratic fascist says corporatism using a state buffer. There is fascist theory, of course. Francois in Spain knew this. Fascism came from Marxist theory. Okay, so what then separates you from a democratic socialist? Because my understanding is, you know, fascism is like national socialism, and national socialism is socialism plus nationalism. So we're going to, you know, do right by the American people. Yeah. And the way we're going to do it is with socialism. To me, that sounds like nationalism and like economic populism. Like, I mean, frankly, that's kind of what Trump was doing. I hate to use Trump and fascist in the same sentence because that's what everyone does. And it's boring and reductive and conveys entirely the wrong idea. But Dan Stewart says everybody gets their money from somebody else. That is correct. Hopefully, though, the somebody else you get your money from is not the government, at least to my way of thinking, because I have an anarchist soul, even if I have rejected all ideologies in a flurry of spiritual knowledge and enlightenment. So, democratic fascist says socialists promote the collective, fascists promote the state and normalization of citizen relations. Okay, well, you know what? You've inspired me. I'm going to take a look more and kind of research this because this is a fascinating idea, and I do love fascinating ideas. All right, so I tell you what, stick around. Let's talk about the IRS and Bitcoin in El Salvador, and we'll see what the democratic fascist has to say about this sort of stuff. So to come back over here, the Foundation for Economic Education points out something very interesting. And they write, another alarming IRS scandal exposed. Because ProPublica, the kind of vaguely left-wing investigative journalistic reporting agency, whatever you want to call it, recently published some tax returns. Not Trump's, but Jeff Bezos and a couple other people. And what they talk about is, hey, look how little these guys pay in taxes. Look at all the stuff they get out of paying. They should be paying their fair share. And of course, the discussion goes, well, do the rich really pay their fair share? What does it mean for the rich to pay their fair share? Don't you know that the American tax burden falls more heavily on the rich than the Swedish one does? The Swedish tax policy is less progressive than U.S. tax policy? So on and so forth. But the guys at Fee have something else they want to point out. So he says Washington politicians are currently pushing to increase funding for the Internal Revenue Service by $80 billion. But we just got yet another example of how the agency's powers are routinely weaponized against Americans for political purposes. We will remember, of course, Richard Nixon doing precisely that. Obama got in trouble for doing the same thing, going after conservative organizations associated with the Tea Party and using the IRS to go investigate those organizations, just make their life hell, you know. So on Tuesday, the progressive-leaning investigative journalism outlet ProPublica published a drove. Is that supposed to be a trove or a drive? I don't know. They published a lot of leaked IRS files intended to expose how some of the wealthiest Americans, like Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, exploit the tax code to pay less in taxes. But as they write, the bombshell itself was kind of a nothing burger. To go back to Trump I remember Trump saying, and I think it was a debate or something like that, and people said, oh, well, why don't you release your tax returns? And he's like, I don't pay a lot in taxes because I'm smart. And everyone's like, what? How could you say this? What are you talking about? And I don't know. I looked at that and I was like, you know, I totally get where he's coming from. Because it's, look, we've got this idea, this very, very silly idea that somehow people like want to pay taxes as like a patriotic duty or something. Most people are not thinking this way. Certainly not most people who have any money. The idea is you get out of paying the taxes that you can get out of paying. And that's about it. And frankly, I'm going to do it. I think if you're watching this and you're a person with self-interest, you're going to do it. You're not going to fail to take advantage of legal ways to reduce your tax burden out of some misguided sense of patriotism, especially with the way things have been going lately, at least for me. I don't want to pay for foreign wars with countries that have nothing to do with us. I don't want to pay for social programs that don't work and freeze poverty levels in place. Frankly, I don't want to pay for most of what the federal government does. I'm a little bit more okay with paying state taxes. And I feel like most of the functions of the federal government could take place at the state level. And the impulse to federalize everything, the impulse of H.R. 1 or S.B. 1, the For the People Act, is the same impulse that wants to institute like worldwide government. Oh, because someone out there somewhere lives under a system that I don't think is just. Therefore, I'm going to go out and use government guns and government coercion, Mao Zedong-style power, to force them to live according to my notion of justice. When I feel like the old school conservatives are, in at least this regard, more correct when they say, look, diversity means when you go to this town over here, they live this way, and you go to that town over there, they live another way. And there's no need for us to even talk about a comparison between them or for town A to somehow impose its sense of justice on town B. Localism. Or as somebody said in the chat earlier, decentralism. So, let's take a look here. Democratic fascist says, yeah, I saw that report. This is the result of corporatism without a state buffer. Okay, we end up with lobbying, and under a more democratic system, the state can't rein them in. Fascism would postulate democracy should be more limited to stop this. Okay, you get more interesting by the second. So are you saying, for example, that you would limit the franchise, like limit who gets to vote, for example? Because the critique here is correct. We end up with lobbying and the state can't really rein them in. There's no mechanism for a state run by people who are elected with corporate lobbyist money to then reform the system that got them elected. Very rare is the person who will reform the system to write themselves out of their own power. There was a guy in the Georgia state legislature who did it. He's the older brother of an old friend of mine, and he wrote a bill for term limits that forced him to not have to be able to run again in the next system. But that's a pretty rare bird right there. And he went back to his life. He was not a career politician. And then Democratic fascist says our current tax system is designed to hurt the middle class through the income tax. The super rich use depreciation to avoid capital gains and offshore to avoid income tax. It's garbage. And then you say, yes, sir, I would limit the voting franchise. I want voting. I want it limited. So limited how? Like, are we talking IQ tests? Are we talking military service like Robert Heinlein wrote about in Starship Troopers? What does that look like? That is very interesting. Because frankly, I also have argued in the past that we might be better off if we limited the voting franchise. That this idea that you want to extend voting out, that you want to have as many people as possible voting, when we know, if we let go of the rhetoric and we let go of the grandstanding and we just look around, we go, man, a lot of people have no clue what's going on in government. A lot of people are voting based on who had a prettier campaign commercial or which party their mom belonged to. They're not parsing issues. They don't have the time, the energy, or the inclination to parse the complex issues that lead to things like democratic fascist here is pointing out, like government being taken over by lobbying, corporatism. Because it's a complex issue, and you got to dedicate a lot of time to figure out how to fix it, or even to understand where it comes from. If I'm working two jobs or I'm raising three kids, I don't have time to sit around and read political theory. I mean, unless I'm really into it. And again, that's a pretty rare bird right there. So to me, that's an argument that, yeah, you could erect some kind of hoops that people have to jump through to be able to vote. Get the people who are most dedicated, the most informed, the people who care the most or have the most at stake. Give them the vote. And you make it much harder for demagogues to come along, for irresponsible populism, let's call it, people who are very charismatic, to seize the imagination of the crowd, promise them stuff, promise them whatever they want, just in order to seize power. Because as we talked about at the very beginning, the people who are least suited to be in power are the people who are willing to do the most to get it. George Washington was a great president because George Washington didn't really want to be president. He wanted to go home. In ancient Roman society, Cincinnatus, or Cincinnatus, if you want to use the Latin pronunciation, was a hero among the Romans. Because in early Republican Rome, at least the legend goes, he was called away from his farm by the Roman Senate and given the title of dictator, which was a temporary position so that the dictator could take control of the state temporarily in order to marshal the forces of the Republican Rome and defeat whatever enemy was at the gates. And Cincinnatus did precisely that. And then, when the war was over, he gave up all of his power and went back to his farm. Power was not an opportunity to go above and beyond and start meddling in the lives of people. It was not something to be enjoyed. It was a sacred duty. It was jury duty. And when he was done, he went home.